Hello, I'm David Soroka. This is number 0571 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0571. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Hank Phillippe Ryan. She's an investigative TV reporter and also a best-selling thriller writer. Her latest novel is The First to Lie. There are some parallels in writing thrillers and in being an investigative journalist.
It has to have a character who you care about and a problem that needs to be solved. You're tracking down clues, as you say, and following leads and doing research. You're taking this huge amount of information and deciding how to craft that into a compelling, riveting story where the good guys win. I mean, I guess they do in investigative reporting, and the bad guys get what's coming to them. And exactly the same in writing a crime fiction novel.
Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, talks about the 3D mapping of the universe.
We live in at least a three-dimensional universe. Scientists have been salivating over trying to be able to get a handle of what the universe looks like. And it's a map of 2 million galaxies. Some of these galaxies are farther away than others. So that's what makes this a three-dimensional map. So you have to remember that space and time are connected. So when you're looking at things farther away from us, the farther you are looking, the farther back in time.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0571, was a very good friend of mine and a plumber to the stars. An actual plumber, not something nefarious and political. An actual plumber to the stars, David Soroka. Thank you very much, David, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A woman entered a Verizon cell phone store in Roseville, California, and refused to wear a mask. Not only did she refuse to put on a mask, which is store-wide policy, the woman proceeded to drop her pants and urinate right in the middle of the store.
Can you hear me now?
In fact, a dispatcher can be heard in a 911 call giving an update to police who were yet to arrive. And by the way, I always marvel that no matter how ridiculous or bizarre a situation is, 911 operators are generally cool as a cucumber, as if any call they deal with is just another day at the office.
They're calling back again and advise that female now pulled her pants down and is urinating inside the business.
See what I mean? The woman was eventually arrested after officers arrived at the scene and discovered several items stolen from Dick's Sporting Goods in her vehicle. Verizon spokesperson Heidi Flatto says the company is requiring all customers to wear masks in their stores and that the incident wasn't just about the company's mask policy, but would not comment further about what else happened. You know, she could have been mistaken, she being the woman who peed on the floor. I mean, she was in a Verizon store. Maybe she thought she was in a P-Mobile. Yeah. Commuters in Berlin, Germany are required to wear masks on public transportation and are subject to fines if they don't. Despite that, so many people wear their masks incorrectly, like covering the mouth but not the nose, that Berlin transport company BVG is now suggesting that riders skip deodorant when they're getting ready for the day in hopes that the body odor on crowded trains will keep those masks in place. Here's a quote. Given that so many people think they can wear their masks under their noses "We are getting tough," read a bright yellow poster on Twitter. "The BVG is calling for a general deodorant waiver. So, now, do you still want to have your nose out?" Wow. You know, this could lead to either repulsion or unwanted attraction. And by the way, you're not just smelling on the train or the bus. You're also stinking up the office when you get to work. Think about that. I don't know if the transit company has. Anyway, farm families in Botswana living beside the Chobe River have long battled herds of elephants that often pass through their fields at night, trampling crops as they move towards the river. Barking dogs and fences have failed to stop the elephants, but farmers are having remarkable success with a new weapon, disco lights. And you know, with disco lights, can disco itself be far behind? Scientists from Elephants Without Borders placed solar-powered strobe lights that flash color patterns along the sides of fields elephants are known to walk through, frightening the elephants away. One farmer reported that before he had lights, "I had more elephants raid, but in the two seasons with lights, I have harvested successfully." Oh, it's all good now, but you know elephants never forget. Just wait until they learn to do the worm, the electric slide, or worse yet, the bump. Then there'll be hell to pay. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, what started as a report of a naked man running down a road hitting cars in Owensboro, Kentucky, on July 16th, soon turned into a home burglary in progress. Davies County Sheriff's deputies said they arrived at the home around 1:30 a.m. to find 41-year-old John Stephanopoulos standing inside, naked and covered with mud and blood. Authorities said the suspect rushed the officers while repeatedly telling them that he had used mushrooms with Jesus and that they were playing a virtual reality video game together. Stephanopoulos was eventually tased and taken into hospital. You know, this story is incomplete. It doesn't mention who won that game, but I suppose they could always go back to it later. I'm sure our Savior kept the game because, you know, Jesus saves. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Hank Phillippe Ryan is a best-selling author of 12 thrillers, and she's won many prestigious awards for her writing, including the Mary Higgins Clark Award and 5 Agatha Awards. She's also an on-air investigative reporter at Boston's WHDH-TV with an impressive 37 Emmys and dozens of journalism honors. Her latest novel is entitled The First to Lie. She joins us via Skype from Massachusetts. Hi, Hank.
Hey, how are you? I hear you're a Boston fan.
Yes, I'm a Boston fan. I'm a Boston Red Sox fan. Nice to have a chance to touch base with you.
Thank you. See, touch base. I saw what you did there.
Yes, exactly. Now, I just read your intro, and all that's going through my head is, my Lord, what an overachiever.
That's funny. You know, I grew up in really rural Indiana. So rural that you couldn't see another house from our house. And my sister and I used to ride our ponies to the library to get books. That's how rural it was. But I do remember when I would bring home my grades from school and I would get an A, and my mother would say, "That's nice, honey. Why don't you get an A+? So possibly that encouraged me in the other parts of my life. But, you know, Emmys are the result of hard work and investigation and sort of the joy of curiosity, of digging to find the answers and to sort of, an emblem of having made a difference in the world. So I'm really thrilled about that. You know, every one of those Emmys means a secret that someone didn't want you to know that my story revealed, and it changed the world a little bit. So I see them as, you know, a sort of wonderful emblem of what a good reporter can do. So I'm proud of them.
You know, I mentioned all of the accolades earlier, and then you put the cherry on top by saying that you were a little girl with a pony.
Oh. Well, you know, it sounds kind of adorable, but and I know it does, but it was actually, Peter, it was actually kind of lonely. I loved my pony. The pony's name was Cadet, cleverly enough. You know, it was very lonely living away from a lot of people, and I do think that what happened as a result of that was that I fell into reading. I loved reading. I would just put myself in the world of a book. And, you know, when you read a good story, the world kind of falls away, you know, and you enter this new land, this new territory. You even become someone else for a while. And you find out what a brave person would do or what a magical person would do. And so I think that opened a lot of doors for me. So, yeah, I loved my pony and I loved going to the library and I loved reading up in the hayloft of the barn behind our house. But that's where I fell in love with storytelling. That's where I fell in love with Nancy Drew and Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie. So that aloneness gave me an opportunity to make a lot of friends in the pages of books.
Now, late last year, I had the opportunity to talk to Humphrey Hawksley, and I bring his name up because he's a BBC foreign correspondent, and he also writes fiction. And I was asking him this question that I'm about to ask you, and that is, do you find that as someone who is an on-air investigative reporter, do you find that some people are a little bit standoffish when they find out that, you know, the woman who's coming to do reporting or to delve into some deep topic also writes best-selling fiction?
Oh, what a funny question. You know, Humphrey Hawksley, you know, what could he be but a foreign correspondent? You know, that is a perfect name. I thought what you were going to ask was whether people were terrified when they heard that I was going to come interview them as an investigative reporter, because yes, they are. I have had, when my producer says, Hank Phillippe Ryan is coming to interview you, I've had people say, no, I don't want to talk to her. She's too tough. And one of the things that's happened during book tour is that people say, I've never seen you laugh. You know, you're the serious one. You're the tough one. So that's the difference. I do think, in answer to your question, finally, that when people find out I'm also a thriller writer, a suspense novelist, they're engaged with it. I think it shows them another part of my life and another part of my brain. And so many people are crime fiction fans. I mean, I've had people say, oh, I just read The Murder List, your new book, The Murder List. And it's sort of a good icebreaker. So I embrace all of that. It's wonderful to have a double life.
Now, investigative reporting is a little different than just general day-to-day reporting, because there's a lot of research and, well, just by the very nature of the term, investigative reporting, there's a lot of investigating to be done. There's a lot of research to be done. It's a similar situation when you're creating a novel. There's research to be done in order to write your story. How does one benefit the other in the two worlds that you live in?
That is such a wise and knowledgeable question, because the parallels are truly significant. Because in an investigative story, it has to have a beginning, middle, and an end. An investigative story has to be a story. It has to be new. It has to be enlightening. It has to be revealing. It has to be compelling. It has to have a character who you care about and a problem that needs to be solved. You're tracking down clues, as you say, and following leads and doing research. You're taking this huge amount of information and deciding how to craft that into a compelling, riveting story where the good guys win. I mean, I guess they do in investigative reporting, and the bad guys get what's coming to them. And in the end, you get some justice, you hope. That's what I'm working for, justice. And you get to change the world a little bit, and you allow the viewers to understand their world in a different and additional way. And exactly the same in writing a crime fiction novel, just the same, a very complicated story made entertaining and compelling and riveting. When you read The Murder List, my book, The Murder List, or when you read my new, The First to Lie, I want you to miss your stop on the T. I want you to miss your stop on the subway or the bus, because you're saying just one more chapter, just one more chapter. So it's all that. I've been a television reporter for 43 years now, and I'm still on the air in Boston. And I have learned, and you know how important this is, I have learned how to tell a story, a compelling story. I don't want you to turn the channel when my stories are on TV, and I don't want you to be able to put my books down. And that architecture, that structure is very similar, very cinematic, very visual, fast-paced, advancing the story at every turn with information that's compelling. So the only thing that's significantly different, and frankly what I worried about when I started writing fiction, was whether I could make stuff up. Because after all these years as an investigative reporter, I've only told the absolute facts as I can figure them out, and the absolute truth, and the only dialogue I can use is what people actually say. But in fiction, anything goes. And it's my imagination that creates this new world. And I was intimidated, I have to say, by that. But Sue Grafton used to call that the magic of storytelling. And it was such a glorious joy when I realized that I could make stuff up. You know, I could make a new world that nobody had ever entered before. So it's been quite a journey. And you should know I have no trouble keeping those two worlds apart. I do my investigative reporting one way, and I do my crime fiction the other way.
Well, I was going to ask about that, and I'll get to that in a moment. But first, you mentioned the title of your latest book, which is why you're here to talk, The First to Lie. Tell us about the book.
Well, The First to Lie is about identity, and it's about a childhood betrayal. The sort of DNA of a Hank Phillippe Ryan novel is a high-stakes psychological cat-and-mouse game between two people, each of whom is trying to prove their truth about a terrible crime, or in this case, about a terrible childhood betrayal. But the question in my book is, which one is the cat and which one is the mouse? So we have an undercover reporter who might be in too deep, and a gorgeous society wannabe who's trying to make her place in this new affluent world, and a corporate executive who is willing to juggle the truth to get people to do what she wants. So again, it's full of conflict, it's full of betrayal, and it's full of secrets. So my cat and mouse thrillers continue with The First to Lie. It's sort of a twisty tale of deception, about how far someone would go to get what they want. And that, what if being someone else could get you what you want? Would you give up your life now and pretend to be someone else if you could get your desires, what you always wanted at the end? How far would you go to get what you want? And will you be the first to lie? And that's what it's about.
You talk about the twists and the turns of your novel. Is that a difficult approach to write? Do you have to really plot out what you're doing before you even, you know, start typing or writing? Or do you have to, or are you able to learn along the way as you write the story?
Well, I always think that when I grow up, I'm going to have an outline for my books. But I do not have an outline, so I don't know what's going to happen next. And so I don't plot ahead. So I don't know what's going to happen next until I write the next line and the next paragraph and the next scene. So that's what gets me to the computer every day, is I can't wait to find out what happens next. And that's how my books progress, because the only way I'm going to find out what happens next is for me to write it. So when people say to me, wow, the twist and the ending of The First to Lie, the twist throughout, not to mention the ending of The First to Lie, or of my book that's on sale in Canada right now, The Murder List, they say, wow, the ending of The Murder List, you really surprised me. And I say, Yeah, wasn't that a surprise? I mean, talk about a surprise ending. I surprise myself every time. And that is also part of the joy of writing, that this somehow this story unfolds on the page. And sometimes I'm typing along and I think, well, where did that come from? Who knew that that person was going to say that? Well, that's so interesting. Really? That's what happened? In the book that I'm writing right now, someone just got killed. And I thought, well, I didn't know that was going to happen. And, you know, readers, it's interesting because every author, every writer will tell you, oh, yes, you know, your subconscious sometimes, when you're lucky and when you're in the zone, your writing brain takes over and the story evolves. I heard a wonderful interview between Stephen King and Lee Child, if you can imagine, the Pantheon. And they both said that this happened to them sometimes, that the story just took off. So in my new The First to Lie and in The Murder List as well, there are moments in those books that still shock me when I read them because I think, gosh, I thought of that. And how did that happen? So that is one of the real glories of being an author, is to find a story that's brand new. Sometimes I open the pages of my book and I read them and I think, wow, I wrote that. You know, this is pretty good. Isn't that so funny to think?
Absolutely. We're talking with Hank Phillippe Ryan. She's a best-selling author of 12 thrillers. Her latest novel is The First to Lie. We'll take a quick break and continue talking with Hank in just a few moments here on The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And The Stuff File program is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. We're talking with Hank Phillippe Ryan, a best-selling author of thrillers and an award-winning TV investigative journalist in Boston. Her latest novel is The First to Lie. And as you mentioned earlier, you've been in broadcasting for a long period of time. You've been writing these thrillers now for a long period of time. Which one came first?
Which is my first book, you mean?
No. Which profession came first?
Oh, I've been a television reporter for 43 years. I started in radio in Indianapolis in 1970, I think. And then I moved into television after working at Rolling Stone magazine and on Capitol Hill in Washington, moved into television in 1975. So you all do the math. And then I had my first idea for a novel 12 years ago, 13 years ago. So certainly the television reporting and all kinds of reporting, television reporting and investigative reporting came first. And that's where I learned how to tell a story. And that's where I learned to dig up a story. And that's where I learned to sort of rely on my storytelling brain. You know, we were talking earlier about whether I know the ending. And, you know, as a television reporter, I don't know the ending of a story that I'm going to be reporting. I'm out there looking for the story. I'm searching for the story. And that's exactly what happens in writing my fiction. I'm searching for the story that I'm writing. So Lee Child and I have talked about this as well, it's a very journalistic method of writing my novels. Is I have a good idea, I have a theory, I have some characters, now let's see what happens to them. And I'm willing to just go for it and see if I can figure that out along the way.
As I'm sure you're well aware, even if you're in the media from a particular time of day to a an endpoint in the day. In doing what you do, it is really all-encompassing. It takes a lot of time to do what you do as a reporter on an ongoing basis. When you first started writing, how were you able to carve out enough time to live a life and also, oh yeah, write mysteries?
Yeah, I started laughing when you said live a life, because that is, you know, it is exactly as you say. I don't want to say it's a sacrifice, because I think I attained much more than I sacrificed. There's no question about that. But when I started writing my first book, oh, I worked all the time. I mean, I worked on weekends and I took every single vacation day that I ever had. And I wrote the book and I wrote it at night. And my poor husband, you know, ate a lot of carryout salmon is all I can say. You know, cooking was the first to go, and then sleeping, and then, you know, all kinds of things that you realize, you know, television watching and going to the movies and having dinner parties and all those sorts of things. You know, we just really stopped doing that. And my husband was incredibly supportive about that. And now, you know, The Murder List, which is on sale in Canada right now, a fast-paced cat and mouse thriller. You know, when I was writing that, I'm completely devoted to that story. So it doesn't feel like carving out time, because when you're in the writing zone, that time just goes away. You know, I'll start writing and then I'll look at the clock and I'll think, wow, 3 hours just went by. Where did that go? And it went into the other world. It went into the world of The Murder List or the world of The First to Lie. And, you know, so you think, wow, did you give up all your life to do this? And I think, no, you know, I got these glorious books and I got this glorious new career and I got to be here and talk to you about it. So, you know, we follow, it sounds so silly to say, but they say, you know, this is my passion. This is what I wanted to do since I was a little girl in the hayloft. And now I think, you know, I get to do this. I'm writing my 13th book now. Who'd have thought that would happen? So I just sort of count my blessings every day about it. I don't look at it as work. I look at it as a joy. That is not to say that there are not bad writing days. And there are days when I think this is the worst thing that anybody has ever written in their entire life. How did I ever write a book? I will never be able to do it again. But, you know, then I think, all right, well, I've got to do it. And it seems to have worked in the past. I mean, The Murder List was just nominated for the Anthony and the Agatha and the McCavity and the Mary Higgins Clark Award. That's the only book in the world nominated, The Murder List, nominated for all those awards. So, you know, in the times that I'm working overnight to get my books done, you know, those are the kinds of joys that I know may be at the end of the tunnel.
That's amazing, though, those four nominations. That's, as you say, unprecedented. Now, you were the past president of the National Sisters in Crime. And as we've mentioned, you're also media savvy because of what you do, your so-called day job. And I'm doing air quotes because you have so many jobs, you can't really say you have a day job. You just keep going. But one of the things I know a lot of authors have some difficulty with, and obviously this is not a problem for you, is that they don't understand or realize that it's just as important not only to write the book, but to help promote the book.
Oh, yeah. That is definitely true. And again, I don't mean to go on and on about being lucky, but my television career after all these years in television has made me really enjoy being able to talk to new people and to meet people and to do public appearances and Skypes and Zooms and book clubs. You know, I love book clubs, and I would love to have your viewers find my website, hankphillipuryan.com, and invite me to be in their book clubs. There's a wonderful Canadian author, Hannah Mary McKinnon, who's a dear friend, and she and I do a Facebook event every Tuesday and Thursday at 11:30 a.m. on Facebook called First Chapter Fun, where we read the first chapters of another author's, a different author's, a new author every Tuesday and Thursday's book out loud to introduce readers to new authors. So yes, the promotion element of it is quite a big puzzle piece in this. And I'm lucky that I enjoy it, you know, in these horrible times where we are now, that we can meet by Skype and Zoom and StreamYard and all those other things. I really feel lucky that we're able to stay connected as we are. And from the standpoint of having a book launch, as I am for the 1st July, where everyone has to stay home and can't come to the bookstores and libraries and celebrate with me, you know, that's a hurdle. It's a big hurdle. It's a big hurdle for all authors right now, which is why we're so enthusiastic and joyful about all the readers who are congregating now on all those platforms, on Facebook and Instagram and here on the radio, to talk about books. You know, I always say it's always safe inside a book. And that's one of the things, the word that I'm trying to spread by whatever means when I'm talking about The Murder List and The First to Lie. You know, these are things that we can share, and these are safe places that we can all be together.
You talk about the times that we live in. I've talked to several authors over the last little while during this quarantine period. And of course, most authors are generally, well, for lack of a better term, hermits. But again, you have this busy lifestyle of being a reporter as well. So how has the whole pandemic period affected your life, good, bad, or indifferent?
Good, bad, and indifferent. I think all those come into play. I'm doing television reporting from home now, interviews by Zoom. You know, a lot of it we can do online, by email, by research, by document searches, all those kinds of things. My producer and I are still working like crazy. You know, I have to say that the pandemic initially, and that has not gone away, initially I was very deeply unsettled and frankly terrified by the whole thing. And I was really unable to read, to write, to work, to do anything for a while. You know, I focused on television because getting the news out and making sure people knew what to look out for and what to do and how to handle things was more important at that time than my writing. Still, though, as you well know, I have a contract for a book that's due when it's due, and the pandemic doesn't make any changes in that. So I sort of have learned to compartmentalize. That I have a time now that I set to write every day because that's my job and I love it, as you know, and I have to write and I have to try to take off this veneer of terror that overlays everything now and just again find safety and solace in the pages of the book. You know, I used to be on book tour for every book. You know, this time last year I was packing and printing boarding passes, and you know, my publicist and publisher were Forge Books, was organizing a huge multi-state book tour that I was going to be on the road for more than 2 weeks at a time. And now, you know, I'm sitting at my computer with flip-flops on, but still talking to tens of thousands of people. And I'm very grateful for that. All of our lives have changed so significantly. And the days all run together, don't they, for you as well? What day is it? I have no idea. I just keep putting one foot in front of the other and write one word at a time and try to understand that there is no way to plan for anything. I'm lucky that my husband is adorable. I'm lucky that we have a wonderful, safe place to live. And I just take one day at a time. I think that's all we can do. Don't you?
Absolutely. And we live in such precarious times politically and are so divided. I have to ask, as someone who works as a reporter, an investigative reporter, in a business that's being pummeled with the term fake news, and on top of that, you're someone who actually does make a living writing fiction, does that put a target on your back?
Oh, you know, Peter, I think sometimes reporters have had targets on their back for a long time, you know, especially an investigative reporter. My life is to dig up secrets, and my life is to put shine a spotlight on things that somebody might not want you to know. So, you know, reporters are meant to stir up the world a little bit. That's our job. But, you know, a good reporter like I am, a genuinely honest, devoted, respectful reporter, I tell the truth. My job is to tell the truth. My life is to tell the truth. The most horrific possible thing for a reporter is to make a mistake. That's what every reporter fears more than anything. And you see that even in my books. Every reporter in the books, in the murder list or the first to lie, is terrified of making a mistake. So I think one of the things that happens is that people forget that some newscasts are real news. The network news, that's real news, where reporters, real journalists, vet the news and edit the news and check out sources and tell the truth. And that other outlets are commentary, and they make no bones about being commentary. It's commentary. And you can pick your channel of what you want to hear, and the whatever bent your philosophy is, you can hear that over and over and over. But that's not the news. That's just people giving their opinion. And that's fine. I just, you know, my goal is to have people understand that there are two different things. There is the real news. There's journalists. There are journalists. And then there are, and they're telling the truth. They're doing the best they can to tell the truth. And golly, they are not making stuff up. If a journalist, a real journalist made something up, every single other journalist on the planet would be pouncing on them saying that's not true. You know, that's our job, is to uncover the truth. But a commentator, you know, commentary is opinion, and people can say whatever they like. The key is for the listener to understand that through the filter of opinion. So there's news, that's one thing, and there's opinion. And fake news generally just means that someone is saying something that you don't agree with.
Exactly. I want to get back to your book a little bit, and you mentioned book clubs a moment ago, and I'm just wondering, are you affected in any way, shape, or form by meeting the fans or talking to fans of your books? Because they're obviously very personal to you, but they can become very personal to the reader. Do you ever get a pushback on some of the things you do or don't do with a particular character?
Oh, it's so funny to hear you ask that. People are very protective of the characters they love. And they also, you know, it's easy for a reader to have their own ideas about how a book should go. And so I generally just embrace those kinds of things. You know, if someone says, why did that person have to die? Or why did that person have to be bad? You know, I think, well, you know, because that's the story. It could have gone another way, and yet it didn't. But I love talking to readers, and I love hearing what their responses are, because generally, mostly, they're just extremely enthusiastic about the stories. You know, I'm talking about the murder list. I'm thinking of one reader who emailed me, who said she was so surprised as she was reading the murder list that when she finished it, she started back at the beginning and started reading it over to see how I had done it. So my readers are smart, and my readers are wise, and my readers are savvy crime fiction readers. And that's one of the things, one of the techniques that I sort of use in writing my books, is I understand what the reader's expectations are. And it's so much fun for me to play with those expectations and then pull the rug right out from under the readers. So I hear this in book clubs all the time, how I surprised them, or there was a twist mid-book that they didn't ever see coming, and how much fun that is, and how late they stayed up reading. So, you know, I know, I understand, and I have a thick skin enough to know that everybody doesn't love every book, and every book isn't beloved by every person. And that's sort of what makes the world go round, right? And so I embrace all of those opinions. It's fun to talk to people about the books. You know, book clubs are terrific, and they're so reassuring. You know, isn't it, to have a group of people who are wise readers who really want to talk about themes and storytelling and characters and motivation? You know, why would a character do this? Oh, I understand that now. And what would you have done in that same situation? You know, that we live in these books. We live as the characters in these books, and that is really part of the fun that comes out of book club. So yes, you are so right. I love them. And I hope your listeners will email me about having me come join them. We can do it with Skype now and Zoom and all kinds of ways.
Got to ask one last question. You are a mystery writer. You also have a whole host of Emmys. We're talking about an object that has a blunt base and sharp, pointy objects at the top. Where do you keep all of your Emmys, which could be murder weapons in their own right?
They are dangerous, you know, aren't they? I know you've held them many a time, and they are quite pointy, and they are quite heavy. Yes, I'm looking at them right now. They are all on display in my office on a bookshelf, a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf along the wall, with my Agatha Awards and the Mary Higgins Clark Award and my books. And, you know, it's fun to look at them. It's really a reminder of the good that we can do. And no, I am not going to use an Emmy as a murder weapon in any of my books. You would figure that out in 1 second, wouldn't you?
Now, when you get in an argument with your husband, do you make him polish them all?
Oh, no. Nobody touches them but me. And I don't get in arguments with my husband. only the little ones, like whose turn it is to empty the dishwasher. Yeah. That's about as much arguing as we do.
Well, he probably knows better, since he's probably read all 12 of your thrillers.
Well, you know, he's a criminal defense attorney. So he is not easy to win an argument with. So we are a very good a defense attorney and an investigative reporter and a crime fiction author. We are a pretty perfect team.
The latest book is The First to Lie. It's the one that's coming out. You've also mentioned your previous book, The Murder List. Hank, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It has been a real joy. Stay safe and take care. And I want to thank you and all of your many listeners.
Author Hank Philippi Ryan. Her latest book is The First to Lie. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page number for this show, which is show number 0571, and you'll find links to her website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
There is a new map of the universe out there, and to talk about it, Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, is back. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter.
So, what is the deal with this new map? I understand it's quite encompassing, and there's a Canadian angle, too.
That's right. So we've got Canadian scientists at University of Waterloo that were instrumental in really bringing to life this amazing map that literally, you know, showcases 11 billion years of the history of the universe. It's incredible. I mean, there's galaxies galore everywhere.
So basically what this does is, first of all, it proves Einstein right, correct?
That's right. I mean, what this shows is that we live in a three-dimensional universe, that's for sure. This is stuff that scientists have been salivating over, trying to be able to get a handle of what the universe looks like. And I think one of the biggest things, Peter, when we're looking at this, you know, this three-dimensional map of the universe, is that there appears to be a structure that that is visible in this map. And it's a map of 2 million galaxies. Keep that in mind. And some of these galaxies are farther away than others. So that's what makes this a three-dimensional map. So you have to remember that space and time are connected. So when you're looking at things farther away from us, the farther you are looking, the farther back in time. So everything is a distance when you're looking up in the at the universe. And remember, our vision of the universe is from our planet. We are kind of stuck at this vantage point. So everything that we see in this map that's been created is from our vantage point. There's some things that we can't see that are hidden from the wall of the Milky Way galaxy. And we can't see through that. But there is a very large expansive window that where we can see out of our galaxy and see these other galaxies. These are, of course, islands of stars, hundreds of billions of stars like our sun. A collection of these stars makes up what we call a galaxy. And we think the universe is home to hundreds of billions of galaxies. And in this map, we are actually mapped the individual locations of 2 million of these galaxies. It's a small drop in the bucket when it comes to all the galaxies, but it begins to allow us to see a structure to the universe.
Now, I've seen pictures and models of this, but I have to ask the question. On this new 3D map, are we on it? In other words, is there a you are here moment on this map, or is this looking outward, outwards toward the rest of the galaxies that are out there?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of looks from our, and again, it's from our vantage point. So, you know, we can't send telescopes out to, you know, I mean, the farthest we've been with is with the Voyager, twin Voyager spacecrafts, which are now, you know, piercing basically the solar system bubble and reaching interstellar space. But that, again, is it's really just like as if we stepped out the door of our house, and then you have the entire city that you live in where your house is. Well, that entire city, you know, filled with other buildings and stuff, each of them, if you think of them as a galaxy, is out there, and we're just, our technology has only stepped out our doorstep. So when we've created this map, it's literally from our vantage point. So at the central core of the map is where the Earth is, and then everything kind of spans out from that central core that represents Earth. You are here, and that's at the middle of the map.
One of the things I often ask you when there's a new discovery like this is, besides proving Einstein right, is there anything in this discovery, in this new 3D map, is there anything that confirms what we've always believed to be? And conversely, is there anything that this 3D map dispels as far as what we thought of in the past?
Well, I mean, you know, when you're talking about confirming, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind definitely is that the universe is accelerating in its expansion. And this was discovered, this very peculiar artifact of the universe, the way it works, was discovered only about two decades ago, in that the scientists looking at galaxies across the universe notice that the galaxies themselves are all flying away from each other. We knew that because of the theory of the Big Bang, where everything was in this super crunched, small little, you know, pinhead-sized area, and then it expanded in a giant explosion, instantaneous giant explosion, and then the universe expanded. The thought was up until 20 years ago that expansion would slow down eventually because of the mass of all the galaxies and matter that's within the universe. It would slow it down eventually, and that's not what happened, though. what we've noticed in the last 20 years that the speed of where of which the galaxies are moving away from each other is actually increasing. And this has really left scientists scratching their head. And the only way they could reconcile this with the physics that we know of, the cosmology of the universe, much of which was set by Einstein, and everything that Einstein has told us has been borne out, is that we have to create an extra factor called dark energy. It's this. It sounds like something out of Star Wars, I know, but dark energy is really this unknown energy. We don't know what we don't know what it is, but we can see its effect on the universe. And by placing in that factor into the equation of the universe's expansion, it allows us to make sense of what we're seeing. And in this map that was released, it's kind of reaffirming the structure that we're seeing in the universe. That structure can only be explained by having that unseen force of dark energy being part of the universe, in terms of the recipe of the universe. It's there, and we can see its effect by what the structure of the universe looks like, which, by the way, Peter, is fascinating, because if we look at it on a grand scheme, that structure looks like a web work, almost as if a spider, we're talking about like a spider's web. And all the galaxies seem to be clustered along the web of this, and there's large voids and then these thin streams of galaxies. And that's the structure that's through and through the universe.
So the universe continues to expand. Do we have any idea as to whether it can expand indefinitely, that there's no wall on the far ends that it can touch? And conversely, does that expansion in any way, shape, or form affect us here?
Well, the expansion seems to be ever increasing in speed. So, you know, it's kind of a sobering theory. I mean, you know, the idea, if you think billions of years or perhaps even a trillion years into the future, and just to put that into perspective, when I'm saying a trillion years in the future, our universe is 13.8 billion years old. That's what we estimate the age. And if we continue into the far future, eventually, now, is there a wall? We don't think so. The theory is that it would expand potentially forever, until the galaxies themselves, these giant islands of stars, will start separating. The distances between them will become ever greater, such that they'll be kind of islands onto their own, kind of just cast out into the ocean of the universe by themselves, far away from any other galaxies. The galaxies themselves will not come apart. So here in our home galaxy, the Milky Way, we would still be here within our galaxy. All our stars that are near us, everything familiar in the in our local galactic neighborhood would be the same. However, our view out of our galaxy, like what these scientists did with this finding, it would show us nothing. There would be nothing visible at one point. In the future universe, our galaxy will appear lonely to us, floating in the darkness of space.
So our own galaxy doesn't expand per se, but the spaces between galaxies does.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that's what we're seeing. This study is also confirming that, showing us, and the structure that it shows us bears that out as well. So again, it's a check mark for us that we're on the right track in understanding how the universe works. Everything that we think of Peter, we come up with theories and we test them by observation. So we take our telescopes and we do all our observations and different wavelengths of light, X-rays, gamma rays, visible light, and we see if our theory is borne out. And in this case, it definitely does show us that the universe is accelerating at an increasing rate, and that we are clustered together on a web-like structure throughout the universe. All galaxies are in those kind of web-like structures.
Fascinating stuff indeed. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, Andrew. Thank you once again for being here with us.
My pleasure, and clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the Night Sky Guy, and author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0571, and you'll find links to his site and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. Also, we were hoping to bring you an update on the Neowise comet that we talked about a couple of weeks ago back on show number 0569, but we ran out of time. However, Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
51-year-old Wendy Wine of South Rockwood, Michigan, was arrested July 17th after offering an undercover state trooper $5,000 to kill her ex-husband and giving him money for travel expenses. Wine met the trooper after allegedly visiting the fake website rentahitman.com, where she completed a form requesting a consultation and named her ex-husband as the target. The owner of the website contacted Michigan State Police, who sent the undercover officer. Said State Police spokesman Lieutenant Brian Olesik, "I'm very surprised that someone thought this website was a true website." The website owner said over the last 15 years, he's been contacted a number of times by people wanting someone killed, and he turns all those requests over to law enforcement. Folks, you have to go to this website, which again is rentahitman.com. It's hysterical. And once you're there, you'll be asking the same questions I'm asking now. Why would someone think that they could simply find a hitman to kill someone by going to a website called rentahitman.com? One reason, and one reason only. They're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0571. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0571. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, Airchecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.